Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S. officials warn Russia against violating a Ukraine ceasefire deal. We continue our conversation on Egyptian-Russian relations.
Neither Russia nor Egypt can do anything to seriously help each other if either is in trouble. And I think that both of them really know it.
Vietnamese youth embrace environmental activism. And can we trust our memories? It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Senior U.S. officials are welcoming a new ceasefire deal to end the war in eastern Ukraine and are warning Russia against taking any steps to undermine it. As VOA's Mary Alice Salino reports from the State Department, top officials say for the time being, the U.S. is not imposing more sanctions against Russia or increasing security support for Ukraine.
Even as a ceasefire deal was reached in Minsk Thursday between the leaders of France, Germany, Russia, and Ukraine, top U.S. administration officials say they were getting reports that heavy military equipment was still flowing across the Russian border into Ukraine. One top U.S. official warned Russia, quote, in the strongest possible terms, against such action, saying it seriously undercuts the new accord. The agreement calls for a ceasefire starting at 12:01 a.m. Sunday for the withdrawal of heavy weapons by both sides, for Ukraine to pull back from the current line of contact, and from Russian-backed separatists to withdraw to the line agreed upon in a Minsk deal in September. After that, Obama administration officials say a complex set of steps will take place over time to fully restore peace and sovereignty to Ukraine. Secretary of State John Kerry said the U.S. will judge the commitment of Russia and the separatists by their actions, not their words, a point echoed by spokesperson Jen Psaki.
We will see, and we are clear-eyed about the potential here. We have seen the Russians say one thing and do another over the course of the last several months. The first test of whether this agreement lays the groundwork for a more comprehensive settlement is the run-up to the ceasefire, and I think we'll all know more after we see what happens this weekend.
Secretary Kerry added that if the latest accord and the September Minsk deal are fully implemented, the United States will consider rolling back sanctions on Russia. A senior official pointed out the U.S. will bring back to the table the possibility of more sanctions and security support for Ukraine if the deal is not fully implemented. Another top U.S. official said Russian President Vladimir Putin may have more incentive to honor the agreements now, with his economy faltering due to falling oil prices, sanctions, and its political and economic isolation. But with escalating violence in eastern Ukraine in recent weeks, the resolve to end the fighting is far from clear as a ceasefire deadline draws near. Mary Alice Salinas, VOA News, the State Department.
After months of turmoil and the president's resignation last month, Yemen appears to be collapsing as its various population groups cannot find common ground. Houthi rebels have taken control of the capital, Sana'a, sparking protests by rival groups as well as supporters. Their leaders say they want to share power with others in Yemen, but Zlatica Hoke reports there have been no apparent steps in that direction.
Thousands have marched in Sana'a and other Yemeni cities against the Houthi takeover. The leaders of the Shia faction coming from the northern mountains have moved into the presidential palace and residence. They have dismantled the government and are forming a new council to run the country's affairs. They also have supporters in Sana'a. The head of the Houthi media office told VOA the departure of foreign diplomats will have no influence over the situation in Yemen.
The coincidence of the closure of these embassies in Sana'a is that they found out they have no power to control the will of the Yemeni people who rejected the foreign intervention.
Houthis have confiscated U.S. embassy vehicles at the airport in Sana'a. They say they will hand them over to the United Nations. There is speculation that Iran is arming the rebels and directing their moves. A U.S. government spokeswoman Thursday said there is no clear evidence of that.
Houthis have concerning relations with Iran, and we are aware of reports of a variety of support provided by Iran to the Houthis, but we have not seen evidence that Iran is exerting command and control over the Houthis' activities in Yemen.
Yemen's President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi resigned last month after the Houthis raided the presidential compound. He's a former military officer who led a unity government and was a U.S. ally in the campaign against terrorism. His departure raises fears that al-Qaeda will use the political turmoil to its advantage. Houthi leaders have said they are eager to share power with rivals and work with Yemen's traditional allies, including the United States. Meanwhile, their supporters carry posters with anti-American messages, and while they warn against attempts at destabilizing the country, they seem to be doing just that. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said Thursday that Yemen is on the brink of a civil war.
Yemen is collapsing before our eyes. We cannot stand by and watch. The country is facing multiple challenges. A dangerous political crisis continues in Sana'a. President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi, Prime Minister Khaled.
Mr. Ban called for freedom of movement for Yemen's president, prime minister, and cabinet officials who have resigned. He also expressed concern about reports of excessive use of force to disperse peaceful demonstrators and arbitrary arrests of civil society activists and journalists. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Russian President Vladimir Putin earlier this week made his first trip to Cairo in almost a decade. On the agenda, economic ties, the fight against terrorism, and military cooperation. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy discusses the trip in part two of our conversation with Mark Katz of George Mason University.
What do you make of the Egyptian media's portraying the visit as a sign of a role model of friendship that could benefit Egypt more than its close relations with the U.S.?
Yes, well, I think that a lot of this press is obviously subservient to the state. I think that what they're trying to show is that Egypt has other opportunities. And I think that, from the point of view of the Egyptian government, no matter what they do, the Western governments, which are democratic, are never going to consider Sisi fully legitimate, whereas Russia, which is an authoritarian regime, doesn't have this problem. So I think that the fact that two authoritarian governments are willing to accept each other, that may make them both feel good, but I think that the larger question is, in fact, can each maintain public support? And that it doesn't help either that they're being criticized by the West, by human rights activists, by democratic opponents, that even though these forces may seem quite weak now, authoritarian governments are very nervous that they don't like the existence of any of these forces. It may sound good, to these governments, but I don't think that it's a message that in the long run, neither Russia nor Egypt can do anything to seriously help each other if either is in trouble. And I think that both of them really know it.
Syria came up into the talks between Putin and Sisi. Could Egypt help Russia in finding a political solution to the Syrian crisis?
I think the main benefit for Russia of the Egyptian position is that the Egyptians seem to be willing to at least tolerate Assad, and that the Russians appreciate that greatly. What they're hoping is that the Egyptians might persuade other Arab governments that Assad is the least worst likely alternative in Syria. And to that extent, Russia values Egypt's position. On the other hand, it's just not clear that anyone can bring about a negotiated solution in Syria. It just seems to have gotten so far out of hand that it's not clear that's possible at all.
Mark Katz, Professor of Government and International Affairs at George Mason University.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's VOAnews.com. VOAnews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Vietnam's transformation from poverty to a fast-growing economy has taken its toll on the environment. But those who will be worst affected, young people, are taking action to change things. Marianne Brown reports from Hanoi.
The rickety footpath along Long Bien Bridge, one of Hanoi's most famous landmarks, is lined with people wearing matching T-shirts. They call themselves the CARP team and carry posters stating don't drop nylon bags with the fish. One of them, 22-year-old Lê Thị Lai, explains. She says 7 days before Tet, the Lunar New Year, it's traditional for Vietnamese people to release three fish to accompany the kitchen god, a deity that lives in every family's hearth, when he returns to report back to the Jade Emperor. The problem is, Lai says, that many people toss the fish along with the plastic bag they came in. This not only pollutes the environment, but can kill the fish. The CARP team's solution is to collect the plastic bags to recycle and lower the fish down to the riverside in a basin so they can be released there. The students are not only active at Tet, says 21-year-old Hoàng Hồng Vy. She says they also support Earth Hour and are planning a cycling event in June to raise awareness of water pollution. Their work is just part of the grassroots activism which has grown over the last few years, alongside increasing concern over environmental issues. Vietnam's rapid growth has had drastic environmental consequences, with polluted waterways and extensive biodiversity loss. The country is rated 136 out of 178 countries on the 2014 Environmental Performance Index, including a rating of 170 for air quality. That puts its overall environmental performance behind China, but its air pollution is not as heavy as the notorious smog choking many Chinese cities. With environmental problems worsening in big cities like Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City, residents are becoming more concerned about the environment because it affects their lives and their children, says Nguyen Chi Thang, Senior Programme Officer for the Environment for the Asia Foundation.
In Hanoi, you can see some, you know, at intersection, a few young people, you know, with banners say, you know, if you stop your bike for more than 30 seconds, you can just turn it off to save the energy and save the environment. I think they're really concerned about and the you know, the way people behave. They really try to, you know, promote the green behaviors among the people living in big cities right now.
Air pollution is a particular worry for families in the big cities. Combustion engines in cars and motorcycles are one of the leading pollution causes in Vietnam, a problem which is set to worsen as traffic increases. There are now around 37 million registered motorbikes in the country, according to local media, up from 32 million in 2008. In an effort to curb emissions, the government roadmap will tighten emission standards for automobiles in 2017 and again in 2022. The increasingly stringent standards are set by the European Union to control air pollutants released into the atmosphere. While Vietnam's government recognises the problem, tackling air pollution is not a priority at the moment, as the government is putting more of efforts into mitigating water pollution, Tang from the Asia Foundation says.
I know some people in Ministry of Environment and Natural Resources, they are working on, you know, some kind of regulation, a more stricter regulation on air pollution, but it's not coming out yet. But I think in the future, maybe, you know, Ministry of Environment and in working with Ministry of Construction and Ministry of Transportation to maybe issue more regulation on air pollution.
Lai from the CARP team says she thinks protecting the environment shouldn't be the responsibility of one group of people. Pollution affects everyone, she says, so it's everyone's responsibility to do something about it. Marianne Brown for VOA News in Hanoi.
This week, the U.S. television network NBC suspended Brian Williams, its top news anchor and managing editor of their nightly news program. All of this came about because he had exaggerated his role covering an Iraq war story in 2003. Williams gave differing accounts of a story involving a U.S. military helicopter that was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade. Williams himself has claimed he misremembered his words, the incident, by combining it in his mind with other factual memories. Experts agree that the psychological mechanisms that produce what we remember as the truth are part of a complex, highly fallible process which can have important consequences. VOA's Adam Phillips has this look at the issue.
University of Illinois psychology professor Daniel Simons is an expert on the psychology of memory and perception and how they can go awry. The co-author of The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us, says that one of the most interesting things about us is how we assume we know our own minds.
And we often are wrong. We assume that when we remember something that's really vivid, really emotional, really detailed, that we must be remembering it accurately, that the way we remember it is the way it actually happened. But the reality is that our memories are not like a DVD that you play back in perfect fidelity every single time. Our memories are more like an improvisation. Each time we tell a story, we're reconstructing what happened. And when we reconstruct things, our memories can change. They can alter, they can shift, they can introduce things that didn't happen, and things that did happen can kind of fade away.
Simon says this is because the main purpose of memory may not be to recall things exactly, but to use our past experiences to make sense of new things that happen and to help us predict what may happen in the future. The actual source of a memory is often forgotten or distorted.
So memory is, in a lot of ways, like telling a story. And of course, when we're telling a story about ourselves, we become the central actor in the story, and we become more and more central to the event. We've all had this experience. Maybe you have this great joke that you're telling to somebody, only to realize that the person you're telling to is the one who told it to you. Or maybe you have a childhood memory of, say, getting your hand slammed in a car door, only to realize that it actually happened to your sister or your brother. We have these sorts of memory failures all the time.
To test his assertion, Simon suggests this simple experiment.
If you have a really emotional memory, something that is really important to you, try writing out everything that you experienced in detail. And if other people were there with you at the time, email or write them and have them do the same thing, but don't tell them what you remember. And you'll likely find some pretty big discrepancies.
Today, well-known people like Brian Williams have copious records on the internet and other media that make their assertions about what happened to them in public relatively easy to verify or challenge. But most people may have only their own memories to rely on. This can have far-reaching consequences. Simon cites a recent National Academy of Sciences report that bears this out. Along with prosecutors, police, defense attorneys, judges, prisoner advocates, and other psychologists, he was part of a panel that examined cases where crime suspects were misidentified in police lineups or wrongly convicted based on eyewitness testimonies. The report also recommended ways to prevent those mistakes.
And the reason they had to do that is that there's now 40 years of research showing that memories for things we've seen can change. We can become more confident in our memories even when we shouldn't. We can introduce details that weren't there. We can recognize the wrong person and become more and more certain that the wrong person is the one we saw.
All this is why Simons would not expect Williams' memory to be flawless regarding what happened in his helicopter over Iraq that day in 2003. But he says there is a second point to consider.
Journalists know that if you have an unreliable or questionable source, you need to find other sources to corroborate the evidence to make sure that it's right. And memory is an unreliable source. It's hard to imagine that we're remembering things that just aren't true. But once you know that that happens, journalists, in a sense, have a responsibility to do that.
Daniel Simons is a psychology professor at the University of Illinois, specializing in memory and perception. He is also co-author with Christopher Chabris of The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
U.S. President Barack Obama plans to sign an executive order today aimed at encouraging companies and organizations to share more information about cybersecurity threats with the government and each other. Mr. Obama will sign the order at a White House conference on cybersecurity and consumer protection at Stanford University in California. The order will direct the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to work on voluntary standards for the entities sharing the information. The move follows high-profile hack attacks against Sony Pictures Entertainment, Anthem Health Insurance, Target, Home Depot, eBay, and J.P. Morgan Chase. The U.S. government also has suffered cyber attacks. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On February 13, 1689, the British Parliament presented the English Bill of Rights to the future King and Queen, William and Mary, the Prince and Princess of Orange. They accepted the document that not only limited royal power, but gave Parliament the right to tax. It remains one of the basic documents of English constitutional law. In 1777, the notorious French aristocrat, politician, philosopher, and writer, the Marquis de Sade, was arrested and imprisoned without charge in the Vincennes Fortress. De Sade was famous for his unrestrained sexual practices, which got him into trouble with the law. The words sadism and sadist are derived from his name. On this day in 1668, Spain recognized Portugal as an independent nation. In 1866, a notorious gang that included Jesse James and Cole Younger committed their first bank robbery in Liberty, Missouri. In 1883, the noted German composer Richard Wagner died of a heart attack. In 1923, retired U.S. Air Force general and renowned test pilot Chuck Yeager was born. Yeager was a key figure in the best-selling 1979 book and 1983 movie entitled The Right Stuff. In 1931, New Delhi became the capital of India. In 1935, a jury in Flemington, New Jersey, found Bruno Hauptmann guilty of the 1932 kidnapping and murder of the Lindbergh baby, the son of famous aviator Charles Lindbergh. Hauptmann was later executed for the crime. In 1960, France exploded its first atomic bomb. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Following a long delay caused by political infighting, the Somali parliament has overwhelmingly approved Prime Minister Omar Abdulrashid Ali Shamarke's selections to head cabinet ministries. The 191-22 vote sets the stage for lawmakers to ratify the Constitution and pass a variety of urgently needed laws to prepare for presidential elections in 2016. The country's parliament was at an impasse since October, when differences between President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud and then Prime Minister Abdulwali Sheikh Ahmed reached a pinnacle. The dispute led to Ahmed's dismissal and the eventual appointment of Shamarke. Since then, the new prime minister has faced an uphill task in convincing lawmakers that his cabinet choices will help end Somalia's long-running political crisis. With approval of his cabinet selections, the prime minister said his government will improve security, justice, health, national reconciliation, and the country's infrastructure. The United States welcomes the February 9th parliamentary confirmation of Somalia's Council of Ministers. As the new cabinet assumes office, we urge the federal government of Somalia to make swift progress in the important work that remains to realize its vision 2016, including a constitutional referendum and national elections. Somalia's progress toward realizing its peace-building, governance, and security goals is of critical importance to the people of Somalia and the broader region. The United States is committed to supporting the government and people of Somalia. We look forward to strengthening our partnership with the Somali government and people as they work to stabilize and rebuild their country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.